Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 16th of June, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with David Taylor and Phil Bishop from the Construction Index. I was going to say that I was looking forward to the end of lockdown next week, Phil, but I checked and it said not before the 21st of June. So sure enough, we've got to wait another month. That's a bit of a bummer, isn't it?
Yes, but the sun is shining, so be grateful for small mercies.
Okay. Haven't looked outside today. What have we got to talk about today then, Phil? Some big global issues, I think.
Yes, well, I think we should go off-piste a little bit. We normally talk about things we've been reporting on the Construction Index website. We haven't mentioned this in our news coverage this week, but it's been everywhere else, and it's the big macro issue. And I think there are things in here that we can get our teeth into a little bit, or our tongues around, which is the G7 meeting down in Cornwall last week. And I am particularly interested in the idea that, this has been presented in different ways by the White House and by Downing Street, but the broad take on it is that the G7, which is the group of the seven, I think they say the seven largest economies, democratic economies, but I'm not quite sure. I'm sure South Korea must be bigger than one of the seven.
Yeah, I would have thought so.
But maybe it isn't. Anyway, the G7 have decided that they want to challenge, rival, compete with China's Belt and Road Initiative, which I always want to call Belt and Braces. Belt and Road Initiative.
I think ours is called is Belt and Braces, really, isn't it? Well, I'm not sure it's that well prepared. But anyway, go on. Let's get into it.
For those who aren't up on their Chinese politics, the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative was a big geopolitical initiative launched by Xi Jinping, the Chinese president, premier, in 2013, I think, something like that. The idea being that the overall picture is trying to recreate the Silk Roads from China to Europe across Asia and so on. Essentially what they're doing is they are funding or lending money to lots and lots and lots of infrastructure schemes, ports, highways, railways. It's mainly transport, but also I think energy, maybe dams, around the world. I mean, predominantly Asia, but also into Europe.
Yeah, and Africa.
And Africa, absolutely.
Yeah.
And it is a way of, yes, it's China investing in infrastructure, but in a political sense, more importantly, it's putting itself front and centre as a political superpower. Those of us of a certain age who remember the days when China was sort of before it opened up and didn't really stick its head above the above the parapet, and I don't think it even appeared at the Olympics until the 80s, 90s or something.
I don't know.
And obviously China is now a very different country, having opened up, and it is the second biggest economy in the world, and before long it will be the biggest economy in the world.
Quite interesting. I read the other day that back in 1979, which, depending on your age, doesn't seem that long ago, or it seems like ages ago, back in 1979, China's economy was about the size of Italy's. And I know Italy is a member of the G7 and all that, but it's still quite a small economy in global terms. So an awful lot has happened in the last 40 or so years.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. I haven't been to China for about 10 years, but there's or more actually, maybe 15. But I used to. There was a period of time when I was travelling there quite a bit, and I think the first time I went would have been, 95, something like that, 1995, 1996, and it was starting to open up, and there were some tall modern buildings. And then to go again, sort of every 2 or 3 years, And up until, I'd say, the last time I went was probably 15 years ago. The scale of development, and I'm sure it's continued just as much, and there are all sorts of statistics about how many lines of miles, kilometres of motorway and high-speed rail and dams and power stations and nuclear power stations and things that have been built in China over the past 20 years. But it's just been massive development. And as we know, everything we buy is made in China. Even things that we think are American, like a nice Apple iPhone, is absolutely made in China. I mean, it's all made there. And this is particular cause for concern to the US economy, because US manufacturing is all but collapsed. I mean, their heavy machinery, their crane manufacturing, Caterpillar's still a big company, we know that, but their car manufacturing and so on is absolutely nowhere on the world stage compared to what it used to be. And the previous president, Trump, was very keen to get domestic industry back up on its feet and explore protectionist measures, tariffs on steel imports and machinery imports and so on. And Joe Biden is similarly, from a different perspective, but similarly keen to invest in infrastructure.
Trump did talk quite a lot about sort of launching a rival or equivalent to the Belt and Road Initiative, didn't he? I mean, he didn't do much about it, didn't really get up, well, it certainly didn't get off the ground. But he sort of raised the topic. He talked a lot about China and how we need to counter its expansionism. So I imagine that this is picking up on that trend. You know, but Biden's quite bullish about this, isn't he?
Yes. Apparently, it's Biden, according to press reports I've read, it's Biden that brought it up with Boris Johnson. Johnson is more important than he otherwise would be, because he was the host of the G7 meeting. So the idea that we're going to have a G7 equivalent to, or it's not an equivalent at all, but a G7 alternative to, better word.
Counterbalance, I think, was the phrase that,
Yes, well, I think that's a more apposite term, I'm sure. And they call it, by the way, I haven't mentioned this, B3W, Build Back Better World, is the plan, which is a dreadful name, but Build Back Better
clunky, isn't it?
Yeah. is a Johnsonian expression, it seems. Build Back Better World, B3W. So we've got B3W versus BTR, Belton, what's it? What's not Belton Places? What do you call it? Belton Road, BRI. B3W versus BRI.
But it seems Biden and Johnson have slightly different take on this, don't they? Because Biden is talking about, a direct response to the Belt and Road Initiative, and Boris Johnson seems to be, I don't know, he calls it a green Belt and Road plan, doesn't he? And I don't know why they're not calling it the same name. He talks about a green Belt and Road plan, and he talks in terms of providing G7 investment to developing countries to help them combat climate change. So he's talking about various sort of green renewable energy projects and that kind of thing. And I think that Biden's emphasis is, well, perhaps not quite as focused as that. And he's talking about, obviously, the carbon reduction element, but he's also talking about general infrastructure investment and really, I think, essentially getting a lot of these developing countries on side.
Well, I think the difference in, and it's nuanced, but the difference in perspective between, and I wouldn't say it's necessarily Biden versus Johnson, but more so much US versus UK or Europe even.
Yeah.
In the UK and Europe, I think the climate emergency has much greater public traction. And if you were to say to the British electorate, the German electorate, the French electorate, we're going to spend money to save the planet, you'd win votes. In America, less so. If you say we're going to spend money to save jobs, I think in America is a much bigger vote winner. So what the American message seems to be is their drive on all of this is all about the human rights abuses in China, the labor camps and the and so on. And so they're flagging up the fact that their agenda or their higher moral ground for B3W or Green Belt Road, whatever you want to call it, is that it's trying to do things about improve labour conditions in China. Now, to me, the subtext of that is that China builds things too cheaply. We want to make it more expensive to build things in China so that we can compete with China at manufacturing. Yeah. And, well, we don't, Britain doesn't, I don't think we can begin to compete with China at manufacturing in the way that America might hope to. And so we're more, we're more interested, our narrative is save the planet rather than save jobs. That's how I see it.
Because I think that in the West, the Belt and Road Initiative is, from a Chinese perspective, it's presented as China extending its largesse to developing countries, helping them develop, build infrastructure, and generally improve world trade all round. Obviously, with a certain element of self-interest, because China wants to deal with these countries and trade with
sell
them.
Sell to them, yeah.
Yes, to sell to them. From the West point of view, I think it's seen as a... In fact, I saw the word neo-imperialist used to describe it, because it's basically extending influence. It's not just helping people. I mean, they're not being entirely altruistic here. It is very much self-interest. And there's this question of what's been described as debt diplomacy, which... I don't know. I can't think of any specific examples. In fact, the only example I can cite of so-called debt diplomacy was in Sri Lanka, where the Chinese funded the development of a huge port and a new airport, so a seaport and an airport. And supposedly, when Colombo, the government in Sri Lanka, couldn't continue with its repayments, China decided to repossess the facility, and so now it's got a foothold in Sri Lanka. I know that argument is contested. People say that isn't actually what happened, but examples of that have been noted around the world, that China is doing this. It's basically building things in other countries, and ostensibly for the use by that particular host nation, and then basically taking it over and using it as its own. And I think that that has raised alarm bells in the West, and is probably one of the reasons why the US is keen to counter it now.
Well, it's we're talking as if it's only in Africa and Asia and perhaps far flung bits of edges of Europe that China's investing and lending. Mm-hmm. And we're forgetting, of course, that the Chinese government owns a good wadge of Hinkley Point power station.
Yeah.
It has the rights to build another power station, nuclear power station, we're talking here as well, in this country. It is a partner with Manchester City Council and other local authorities in the northwest that own Manchester Airports Group. It's in bed with them. So the British local authorities are in bed with the Chinese government.
Yeah.
This is not all something that's happening in far-flung places. And of course, when the Chinese first they were invited here. This is all George Osborne's.
Yes, exactly. He's got a lot to answer for that.
If you want to say fault or credit, depending on your perspective. George Osborne, when he was shadow chancellor, before he was chancellor, enjoyed a couple of trips to Shanghai and Beijing. And a friend of mine enjoyed a night out on the tiles with him in Shanghai once, and is out there, and who's terribly, terribly enthusiastic about all things Chinese and very gung-ho. I suppose he's following the old mantra of follow the money. The money's in China. Let's get Chinese money. Let's get China to solve that.
Yes.
Because the context was after the global economic crash of 2010, 11 and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
Capitalism had failed. Lehman Brothers had collapsed. And he was, get money where you can. Let's get the Chinese over. And President Xi Jinping was welcomed with open arms. Yes, come here. And I suppose the rationale, which at the time I had sympathy with, is that the more one embraces these repressive, is that too strong a word? But regimes that are not sort of open Western-style democracies, the more you embrace them, the more you can soften their edges. And it's a whole Coca-Colaization, globalism. And that, by and large, does work. I mean, isn't there saying that we've never been to war with a country that has Coca-Cola? No, has a McDonald's, that's it. Never been to war with a country that has McDonald's.
If everywhere, well, it's the has first McDonald's, time for everything, Phil. I mean, did you say...
If everywhere has McDonald's and Coca-Cola, then we'll all be at peace and we'll love each other, is the theory.
I'm not convinced that cozying up to Xi Jinping will make him any softer or cuddlier than he already is. He's an extremely focused man, and he's got a very clear agenda. So I think cozying up to somebody like that in the hope that you're going to win them over to your point of view, or at least get them to compromise.
No, it's not that you're going to win them over. It's not that you're going to win them over. The realpolitik sort of diplomacy idea is that the more your interests are intertwined, the more likely it is that you will reach peaceful agreement with things, which is why that was a big part of the Remainer argument in Brexit. If we leave the European Union, we become untwined, it undoes 70 years of post-war, mid-20th century peace-building that we've done, or could risk that kind of thing.
Yeah.
The whole question of globalisation is obviously controversial. It can be seen as a pejorative term, and it can be seen as a positive thing. Broadly, I think it's a positive thing for the reasons that I mentioned. That, you know, you don't go to war with people you trade with on the whole. But have you seen? There's a fascinating documentary. It's been sitting around on iPlayer for about 7 years now, called Bitter Lake. Have you seen that up on iPlayer?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's by a journalist called Adam Curtis, who writes sort of quirky essay type things, and it's not a documentary in the conventional sense, but it is all about this topic of globalization, of the interaction of the West, and specifically America. This is not so much about China, this is about the Middle East, Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia and big oil and so on. Mm-hmm. And I thought of this when I was reading about the Build Back Better World G7 counterbalance to Belt and Road Initiative. Because there was a time when it was America, Britain, Italy, France, the West, mm-hmm. that was heavily involved in building the Middle East and funding and building the infrastructure there in the back half of the 20th century. And if we're going to get back into a big push in internationalism for infrastructure projects, I think this documentary Bitter Lake is an interesting view, and I thoroughly recommend it.
All right. I'll check it out.
One particular thing it talks about, which I found kind of mind-blowing, is that basically it's Morrison Knudsen's fault, and I can't remember who the consulting engineers were, but it's the people who built a dam in Helmand province in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. in 1950s. It might have been very late 1940s, but I think 1950s. There were no poppies in Afghanistan until that happened. There was no heroin in Afghanistan until that happened. And it was because they built the dam. One of the byproducts of the dam construction, and don't ask me about the botany behind this, was that suddenly poppy fields emerged everywhere, all around Helmand. And thus began the hippie trail to Afghanistan. And thus was born a new industry, the heroin industry.
Very profitable
in Afghanistan. I mean, it already existed in other parts of the world. China and so on had it for a long time. But Afghanistan had this, and it was created by the Americans, which is an accidental spin-off byproduct of trying to do good and trying to buy influence and move into a country. So that was just a little anecdote, side bit of this whole documentary. So I think if we do start getting involved in other countries, we need to be very careful about exactly what spins off.
Yes, well, I think that the last couple of decades have demonstrated that the way we've behaved in the Middle East, it hasn't exactly covered with glory, has it? I mean, the Middle East, of course, is always a contested region, and that is an area where I read recently China is being very active, cozying up to just about everybody there, the Saudi Arabians, the Gulf states, Iran, and even Israel, because it's taking a morally neutral stance. It like Saudi Arabia, has this belief that in internal issues are nobody else's business. So they're not going to talk about Saudi people being bumped off in Saudi embassies in Turkey and that kind of thing. And the Saudis aren't going to say anything about the Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang province. And so everybody's going to avoid the difficult moral issues and concentrate on the business. And it makes life a lot easier if you take that approach. And so if you're not partisan, I mean, it's making no distinction between Sunni Islam and Shia Islam, is not going to get involved in local arguments and conflicts. It's just going to do business on a purely business footing, and that seems to suit everybody. So it's very quietly getting a big toe in the door down there.
That's how Britain's always conducted its diplomacy, and America. We'll pick a pet dictator in some hot spot, sell him loads of weapons and bombs and aeroplanes and whatever,
yep.
And then when things get a bit awkward, we'll then sell the other side loads of bombs, guns and aeroplanes. I mean, Saddam Hussein was great when he was our bastard, and when he became someone else's bastard, we didn't like him.
No, that's true. That is very true. But that's always been the way powerful countries have behaved. Colonialism is as old as the hills, and it's still going on. We can criticise China, and we do criticise China for being imperialist in its philosophy and approach to global trade. But as you say, that's the way we built the British Empire, and that's the way America became the most powerful country in the world. So the Chinese quite justifiably turn around and say, you can't criticise us for doing what you did over several centuries before.
I have a different take on that, slightly. I agree with you about Britain. We were built on colonialism, as was France, as was Italy. And other countries have had more militaristic approaches to expansion, such as Germany, for example, for a short while. But I don't think America's economic power rests on colonialism, on, I mean, yes, as I mentioned, this Adam Curtis documentary on iPlayer makes clear how it cozied up to the Saudis and got Saudi oil, which was a big deal for it. But I would say America's greatness is founded on exactly the opposite. It's founded on immigration, being your poor and huddled masses. It's the fact that it's historically welcomed anyone with any ambition to get rich through dint of hard work to go there and, you know, start off driving a New York taxi and whatever. And I think that's been the basis of its wealth and success.
Getting back to this Build Back Better world, I've nearly got the hang of that now, this initiative discussed by the G7 last week, were any specific projects or any specific sectors identified as as worthy of all this this investment?
It was, I'm afraid, it was incredibly vague. And more than that, they're not even going to put up any money. this is suddenly, folks, we've been talking it up, and now we go, boop, there's nothing there. There's no money. What they want to do is they're hoping it's going to be some glorified new type of PFI. They want to encourage pension funds and banks and people with money to pump prime and so what it's really doing, it seems to me, is simply trying to steer those or make available finance to some of the poorer nations who are looking to build infrastructure, make available finance with strings, and those strings will be yes, we will lend you money for your infrastructure project, so long as no slave labor, so long as human rights, and most, I think from the Boris Johnson perspective, top of the list is green issues, sustainability, carbon reduction policies are embedded in the project. So it's I think what it's more about is the G7 agreeing what strings to put on loans.
Right. I mean, there was mention of $40 trillion of infrastructure investment, but presumably that's an aspirational figure and it hasn't been allocated to anything.
I think $40 trillion is a figure that someone somewhere has come up with what the world needs to spend on infrastructure to be
right.
lovely and perfect. So it's a bit of a wet finger stuck in the air figure, I'm sure.
Well, we were talking about the G7, and I think the chair of the G7 is the Italian Prime Minister, isn't it? Mario Draghi. And there's been some very interesting news coming out of Italy about infrastructure investment, not in the developing world so much, but actually in Texas, of all places. This was a story that you brought to my attention, actually, and I think it's very interesting. Tell us about it, Phil, because you've got the details there.
Well, I didn't have them in front of me because I can't claim credit for this. This is our colleague Lisa Russell, who does our international news. Texas is having its own HS1, actually, high-speed rail. I think it's going to be the fastest train in the world or something. A new high-speed railway between Dallas and Houston, which you might not think sounds very far with our limited knowledge of American geography, but it's about the distance from London to Blackpool, 240 miles or something. And they're building a high-speed railway there. And the Italians are building it, or Italian-owned company, for $16 billion. And you think, they can get from the equivalent from London to Blackpool for $16 billion, and we can't get from London to Leeds for less than 100. But okay, I think there's a lot more open land and desert.
You haven't got the West Midlands in the way. That's the trouble.
No. What I'm interested in is this company called We Build, which may be a new name to some listeners. It was until about 2 years ago, and Impregilo,
Celini Impregilo,
who have always been a big player on the international contracting stage, particularly in former Italian colonies. We Build seems to have a particularly high profile at the moment. It's helped that shortly after its name change, it rebuilt the Genoa Viaduct, the bridge in Genoa.
That's right. Yes.
Which we've talked about, which raised its profile globally significantly. But it also owns, I think it bought it about 10 years ago, a US construction company called Lane Construction. Mm. Lane is quite a big US construction company. And so We Build and Lane are together building this high-speed railway between Dallas and Houston. They've just signed the contract, financial close expected in the coming months, and should expect to see construction start before the end of the year, I think.
Yeah, but it's quite remarkable because, I mean, they've got a very very efficient and almost hyperactive PR person in their Milan headquarters who sent, I mean, they first sort of appeared on my radar during the reconstruction of that Genoa viaduct. And since then, I've had a constant stream of press releases about various big infrastructure projects in around the world, mainly in Italy and the rest of Europe. But this one, they are especially proud of because of the size of it. I mean, they point out it's the single biggest project of its kind in the United States by value. They're going to be using Japanese bullet trains on this line, so they'll be the fastest trains apparently that you can get. And there was a lovely quote by U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg. I don't know if I can pronounce his name correctly. Buttigieg, who I think wasn't he a Democratic presidential candidate at one stage?
I think he was. His name was in the hat for briefly, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. But he made the point. He said, when it comes to rail, why should Texas be inferior to China? And here we are again. You know, there's this Western response to Chinese development and the pace of Chinese development. And I don't know whether or not it's simply they've simply decided to go ahead with this project because they want to show that they can do what China does. But China's been putting in high-speed rail all over the place for the last decade or so. So America, I suppose, has always relied on highways, you know, Route 66,
and
all that.
Flying. It's very easy to fly around,
yes.
America.
Project is one of the biggest ever won by WeBuild, and they say that it'll be transformative for the group.
But WeBuild, just in the past couple of weeks alone, we've run stories that they've won they've signed that contract, $16 billion, a €1 billion contract to build extend the railway from the Brenner Base Tunnel between mm-hmm. Forteza and Ponte Gardena on the Italian side of the Alps.
Nice pronunciation.
So that's a €1 billion contract they've signed in Italy last week. And this week, they're 70% owner of a consortium that's got the design and build contract worth €367. What's that, 300 million quid? To build a railway, railway between Naples and Bari.
Wow. Okay. I mean, it's quite a big company. It's a €6 billion company, isn't it? WeBuild.
What does that make it? Balfour Beatty size sort of thing, is it?
No, I think Balfour Beatty is about $9-10 billion. I don't know. It's big. It's big and very influential. And as you say, it's done loads of infrastructure work all over the place. They're very proud of their water engineering. You mentioned dams earlier. They've built a lot of dams and sort of water infrastructure stuff. They say they've been recognised for 5 years by Engineering News Record, which is a highly respected American weekly magazine, as the world leader in water infrastructure, such as dams, hydraulic tunnels, water and wastewater management. So, you know, they're a big global player, but this is clearly a major feather in their cap.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the list of top UK construction companies. It would make them about a little bit bigger than Kier, about the same size. Kier had $4.5 billion last, 2019, year to June 2019. But they seem to have a much higher profile than someone like Kier would do. But Kier, conversely, will take on a £10 million school extension. Whereas WeBuild seem to be more like a Lang O'Rourke or something. Or, you know, don't call us unless it's going to cost us £200 million kind of thing. Just the big stuff.
Well, we don't know that they don't do smaller projects. They just don't tell us about it. Obviously, it's the big ones that attract the attention.
Interesting, we haven't had them get anything in the UK yet. And if they're growing at the speed that I have the impression that they're growing, I think we're either going to see them in joint venture with someone pitching. So, of course, you know, if you look at HS2, we've got masses of Spanish and
French and Spanish and Dutch,
and Swedish, and our doors are open to anyone who wants to come in. And so there's a noticeable absence of Italian contractors in the UK.
But
Amy's up for sale. Maybe they'll come along and take Amy off Ferrovial's hands.
Who knows?
Results this morning, another £100 million loss.
Oh dear.
So they're not a happy place. Financially, at least. I'm sure it's a very happy place to work. I don't mean to say that, Amy. I bet it's a great place to work. That's not so good for your shareholders.
Yeah. So, interesting company, WeBuild. And I think that the name changes also, not to be overlooked, the fact that they were called Cellini and Pregillo, which is very Italian. It's definitely an Italian company. WeBuild, of course, being basically in English, makes it far more international.
Or American, if you prefer.
American. Yeah. Yes. Well, in this case, certainly. But it might indicate, you know, a slight change of direction. I mean, we say that they're big internationally, which they are. Maybe they're going to try and do more in English-speaking countries. I don't know. Or maybe it's just that, you know, English is a sort of, you know, the language of international trade. So maybe that's just trying to enhance their status internationally.
Well, I think part of the name change is it coincided with them taking full ownership of Ansaldi. And Cellini and Pagello was itself a merger some time ago. So there's two companies in their name already. And then to call it Cellini and Pagello and so on is all a bit of a mouthful for people like you and I. But yes, the fact that they picked an English name instead of, you know, Milan Contractors or you know, Milano Construction or whatever. Yeah. But I did out of curiosity wonder whether there was a, you know, WeBuild had registered WeBuild Limited at Companies House in the UK to see if, or whether there was a WeBuild.co.uk. And lo and behold, there are actually quite a few companies called WeBuild, all one word, in the UK. None of them Italian owned. So if WeBuild does come to the UK as WeBuild, I think there'll be a few smaller companies going, excuse me, we were here first.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose what it says on the tin, for an English or British company setting up a building firm, it's a bit of a no-brainer. That's what we do. What do? We build. Okay, fine, we'll call ourselves WeBuild, because it, as I said, you know, it tells you what you do. But for the Italians, I bet they spent thousands and thousands of euros getting consultants on board to find a good international sounding name. They came up with that one.
Well, if they moved to Scotland or Northern Ireland, it'd be quite good too. Because they just go, we'll just do a wee build here and a wee build there. Sorry, bad joke.
Yeah. All right, we're talking about Scotland. I don't want to tear you away from WeBuild, but there was a nice Scottish story, which I think was also probably by Lisa on the website this week, which actually carried on from a discussion that you and I had a month or two ago. Do you remember we were talking about a feature that, here she is again, Lisa, wrote for the magazine about a scheme in Scotland by the Construction Scotland Innovation Centre, was basically in charge of this scheme to try and improve the market for homegrown Scottish timber, which was interesting from my point of view, because I hadn't realised that we still import most of our timber for construction work. It's it comes from
Sweden,
Scandinavia. Yeah, we do. Yeah,
I said UK. I said Sweden.
Oh, Sweden. Sorry, I did. My headphones playing up. Yeah, that's right. So we import a lot of our construction timber, the lumber that's used for, you know, all sorts of timber frame structures, and all the engineered timber. And so Scotland Construction Innovation Centre is promoting homegrown timber. And now the Scottish government has just allocated, I know it doesn't sound like much, but it's £7 million for projects to improve the infrastructure used in the transport of timber. So there's clearly a concerted programme here to promote the use and exploitation of homegrown Scottish timber. And, you know, I always think of Scotland as being really the only part of the UK that grows timber on a commercial basis, and that's probably true, but a lot of it is used to make things like chipboard and oriented strand board and that kind of thing. It's not used for sawn lumber or glulam and that kind of thing. That's happening because this project which Lisa was writing about is actually looking into that and using homegrown timber. But this is about addressing the problem of actually getting it from the forests to the market. So they want to do, they're putting £900,000 towards Timberlink, which is it's an organisation which moves around 100,000 tonnes of timber by sea from Argyll to Ayrshire every year, I assume. That's every year. So they want to reduce the timber miles, you know, the embedded carbon and all that kind of thing. And they want to reduce the number of lorries using the A82 trunk road, which of course is over the Rest and Be Thankful, which is a notoriously dangerous stretch of road. Another £340,000 pounds is going to Stirling Council to improve passing places in East Loch Lomond, where timber traffic shares the road with high visitor numbers. And £2.2 million is going to a range of road improvements in the Highlands, where a lot of the timber traffic, obviously, it has to pass. And they're building better sort of minor roads and tracks to link forests and forestry areas to the main sort of road network. So I thought that was quite interesting, the fact that Scotland is obviously focused on this. They're not, you know, the idea of a little project to try and improve the use or the usability of Scottish timber, that can only go so far. You've actually got to make it available, and this is what this is about.
It's clearly good that the Scottish government is supporting Scottish forestry in this way, but I can't help thinking that if we looked at the Scottish Tourist Board website, there might be a different spin on this story, and how fabulous that we've got money for road improvements to promote Scottish tourism. Because, of course, timber isn't grown in the centre of Glasgow or Edinburgh, where nice big roads go to. It's grown in the middle of nowhere, where little roads go to.
Yeah.
And often beautiful places like Loch Lomond and Argyll and so on, where tourists will go to. And if you go on your holidays to Scotland and you spend the week stuck behind a huge great timber lorry moving at 3 miles an hour, you're probably not going to go back. I think these road improvements and widenings and adding passing places and so on will help tourists get around quicker, as well as local commuters, local drivers, delivery men and so on, but will help other motorists more than it will help the timber lorries, because I don't think the timber lorries are going to go any faster.
No, probably not, but if they are hoping to increase the production and use of timber and forest products in Scotland, that might mean, I imagine that it almost inevitably means, that they will increase the amount of wood being transported. So that does mean not necessarily faster lorries,
more of them,
but more of them.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, if there were going to be more lorries on scenic routes through the Highlands, you're going to have even more tourists and locals getting upset by being stuck behind a lorry yet again, you know. So I think that's what it's about. I think it's a rare example of joined up thinking in British government, you know. It's sort of
Scottish government, I think, here.
Scottish, well, yes, exactly. Yes, I'm being generous by including Wales, Northern Ireland and England here, but it's joined up thinking. They've realized that if they want to improve the production and the exploitation of this particular resource, they have to look at the distribution and the logistics and all the rest of it. So I think this is, you know, quite an interesting element.
Are there no waterways they can chuck the trees into and send them downstream that way?
Well, yes, is it the Caledonian Canal, which sort of goes from east to west through the great, I can't remember what that valley is called. But anyway, I'm sure it links Scotland from east to west, doesn't it? So I think they probably already do use that for, I don't know, I'm just guessing they use it for freight. They might not, I don't know. In the back of my mind, I've got a feeling that they do move freight along the Caledonian Canal. But it is also a very important tourist attraction as well. So there's another question of congestion there.
In my old neck of the woods in the Yorkshire Dales, we used to get the Upper Wharfdale route from Skipton to Kettlewell. Always used to get stuck behind, I don't know if Tilcon still exists, but Tilcon trucks from the quarries, huge great lorries. And they improved the roads around there, but more importantly, I think they send a lot of it by a little Chigley railway now. Not huge great trains,
really?
But move it by rail makes much more sense.
Yeah. Interesting. When I lived in the Potteries in Stoke-on-Trent for several years back in my youth, and the Caldon Canal was still used quite extensively for moving. I remember seeing a lot of biscuit-fired pottery on a boat once. I don't know where it was going or where it was coming from, but things like flint, there was a flint mill up the Caldon Canal and that kind of thing. But it was still being used not just for the tourist trade, but also for industry. And I don't know if it is still being used for that. But, you know, that's the big advantage of a canal. If speed isn't of the essence, and if you've got a fragile cargo like biscuit-fired pottery, you don't want it jolting in potholes on the road network. A nice canal boat is far preferable.
Sounds very sensible. Handle your delicate loads on waterways. I have to be honest though, I think if I was by a canal and I saw a vessel with cargo going past, I'd be suspicious because it doesn't, you don't think of it happening. I'd think, first of all, I'd probably think Peaky Blinders. I'd think, oh, no, what are they? Is it guns under those canvases? Or is it what contraband are they trying to smuggle undetected through the secret backwaters of the UK?
Well, there's a big question. No, I would never have thought of the British canal network as being a route for smuggling. I mean, we have narco subs going up and down them with only the conning tower showing, that kind of thing.
You obviously haven't seen Peaky Blinders.
Obviously not. So,
talking of timber, we've still got shortages. Latest statistics, we've talked about this before, looking at it. We're importing more than ever. Huge amount, record imports for... Hang on, I've got the statistics here. Demand for timber and panel products in the first quarter of 2021, highest since the previous high for first quarter in 2007. Nearly 3 million cubic metres was the market. I thought it was just imported. 23% up on last year. Softwood imports rose by 31%. Hardwood imports were down 7%. But lots and lots going, but still masses of shortages.
I noticed that there was another news story which I've just been writing about, actually. The Builders Merchants Federation, you know, the Builders Merchants Building Index, which they produce.
Yeah,
is it quarterly or monthly? I can't remember.
Monthly.
They're reporting on quarter one of this year that there was a huge demand, huge increase in demand for materials reported by builders merchants in the UK, and that was led by two sectors, landscaping and timber and joinery. So, yeah, obviously timber is in short supply, I guess.
And it looks like it's going to continue that way for the rest of the year, I think.
Looks like it.
On that happy note, any other business?
None that springs to mind. I think we've probably ground to a halt now.
Alrighty. Right, well, if we've ground to an actual halt, we will say goodbye for another week. Thank you very much for listening. But for another week, we'll be back same time next week. But for another week, this is myself, Phil Bishop, and him, David Taylor, saying thank you and goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.